Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Hey folks, welcome back. Well, I keep telling you at the end of every podcast that we'll be back next week with another great guest. And here we are again, back next week with another great guest. So today, yet again from the other side of the pond and yet again from Colorado, seems to be a lot of our guests coming from there. Today I have Jim Miller, Chief of Performance at USA Cycling. So firstly, Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, still struggling with COVID over there in the United States, you guys?
Yeah, we're doing a great job with our COVID management here. I think we're leading the world in COVID management at the moment.
Not COVID mismanagement.
I didn't say which way.
Well, we're still struggling with it here as well. You know, we've had a national lockdown twice now, and now we've got a tier system, which is confusing everybody more or less. And then apparently the government have asked COVID to go away for Christmas. So we've got 5 days when we can behave as if COVID didn't exist, and then we have to go back and pretend that it does exist again.
Nice. That's a good solution. I think our president declared COVID defeated about 2 months ago.
Yeah, and now he's about to sort of like walk out the room and leave it behind him.
Exactly.
Although by the time this podcast is aired, he'd probably be on his way out the door. I think, is it January the 20th when they hand over?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh well. We'll wait and see what happens if we get that far. Yeah. Okay, Jim. So, Chief of Performance, USA Cycling. Now, last time we met was Training Peaks Endurance Coaching Summit 2019. At that point, you were working for Training Peaks, I believe. So, it was quite a surprise for me to see that you'd gone back into USA Cycling. How did that all come about?
Yeah, it was not really anything planned. I actually really, really enjoyed working at Training Peaks and working for the people at Training Peaks that I did. I think it's a great company. Coaching is my passion. So working with coaches was like not going to work, to be honest, and talking to people about things you'd like to talk about. I came from USA. I spent 17 years at USA Cycling before Training Peaks. I guess somewhere around January, the CEO of USA Cycling reached out, asked if I would like to have a beer with him. I never say no to having a beer. And we just sat and chatted for a while, and eventually he asked if I would be interested in coming back. And I said, oh, of course, I love high performance. And I think at the end of the day, you are who you are. And that's who I am. And after, you know, probably 4 or 6 weeks of this discussion and sort of working through what he would hope happened in our athletic department, our athletic teams, goals that he had set forth, you know, some concerns that I had. We more or less agreed on the idea that I would come back, and agreed that I would start April 1. This was probably at the end of February. So I built myself a nice little cushion, take a break, do some riding myself. And then COVID happened, and I think probably around March 6th, he called and said, can you start? And I said, yeah, sure. What are you thinking? He's like, tomorrow. And that happened to be a Saturday. So here I am, back in the saddle, back at the helm, and going full gas towards Tokyo, I suppose.
Mm. Do you think that'll happen? I mean, what are the odds at the moment, given what's happening in the world?
I think pretty good. Everything I've heard from our NOC, from the IOC, from the UCI is that it will happen. How it will look or what it will look like could be interesting. There could be no fans. There could be closed venues, closed bubbles. Once you enter it, you don't exit it. It could be, but I think pretty strict and pretty tight. So, but at the end of the day, the Olympics are such a large economy that no one nation can afford to not host them once they go this far. the IOC can't afford to not have them happen. Most of the NOCs can't afford to have them not happen. So I think they have to happen. Mm-hmm. I think that on the heels of Tokyo, you have Beijing 22 in January. And if you cancel Tokyo in July and August of 21, that more or less means you're probably going to cancel Beijing in 22. And I don't even think the IOC could survive two canceled Olympics.
Well, sorry, Beijing, yeah, I'm just thinking of what that might be, Winter Olympics, right?
Yeah, winter, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So 17 years at USA Cycling. Now, I know you're not an old guy, Jim, so I'm thinking that would put you at your early 30s, maybe a bit before that. So what did you do? I believe you were riding. I'm certain that Dirk talked about you and he riding together. Did you ride professionally as a cyclist?
Yeah. In the 90s, I rode professionally on a lot of teams with Dirk. Several teams. They're really iterations of the same team, but we spent a lot of time together. It was just a small professional continental team. Not bad riders, but not World Tour level. We did have some World Tour level guys that rode on the team, but it was on the backside of their careers.
Was that in the U.S. then, or did you ride with Dirk when he was in Belgium?
This was in the U.S. Yep, Colorado-based team. Dirk had came back from Belgium at that point. So small little team, but it was fun. Learned a lot. Love cycling. Everything that comes with it.
Yeah. Were you what sort of rider were you? Roller, climber, domestique, sprinter?
Climber, but mostly domestique.
Okay.
If it went uphill, I'd make the first group.
Okay.
Generally, I would have a teammate with me that was better, so I would end up riding for him.
Yeah. What was Dirk? Dirk's a big guy. Was he a roller? Was he a big gear guy that could roll along undulating terrain, but he'd go off the back once he got to the steep stuff?
Yeah, steep climbs probably were not his thing, but he was a really good climber for a big guy. I think he won a KOM jersey at Core States once. He could get up a hill okay. He would surprise you. But yeah, big, strong guy, big gear. Could ride the front all day long.
Yeah. What about now then? Dirk's into Schemo these days, isn't he? He told me. Do you do that sort of stuff? I mean, was that if you're from Colorado, is that the sort of basis of your winter training? Is cross country skiing and Schemo?
It used to be more so than it is now. We generally have pretty good weather here in the winter. It's really entirely doable. If it does snow on the front range, anyways, it dries up in 72 hours. Roads are clear. The mountains are a different story. I think everybody in Colorado that's into Schemo now is because they were into skiing, and to access the really good terrain and the good snow, you have to get out there on your own and earn your turns, as they say.
Mm. Interesting. I've got a question for you, but well, maybe we'll talk about that now, actually. So when you've got your athletes and they're doing their winter training, do you have a preference for how they keep that fitness during the winter? I mean, I've heard some of the European guys like cross-country skiing. If they were riding, do you mind how they accumulate the miles? As long as they accumulate the miles, are you bothered if it's mountain biking or cyclocross or a combination or even doing some Zwift stuff?
No, I like it all. And it really depends where you're at. If you live in Southern California, Tucson, Arizona, you can ride and you can train. If you live in the northern climates and you get a lot of snow, then you're probably going to cross country ski more than you ride. So I think it really just depends where an athlete lives and what tools are available to them. And then you work with the tools available.
Mm. All about just maintaining that sort of pedaling skills and some base aerobic fitness. Yeah.
Yeah. And if they're cross country skiing, I mean, that's a phenomenal workout, right? Nobody argues that, but I may do a cross country ski in the morning and then back that up with a rollers ride in the afternoon or a trainer ride, Zwift ride or something like that. So it is accumulation of fitness and it all counts.
Do you ride
Zwift? It's all on the bank.
Do you still do much riding now?
I do. Yeah. Yep. I try to ride. I probably try to ride 5 times a week.
And you're Zwifting?
I was whipped when it's nasty outside. We got about an inch of snow last night, so there's no way we're going out on the roads today. So I'll probably jump on the Zwift at some point today.
Right. Do you get him? Is the old racing urge still there when you're on Zwift?
It can get there in a hurry. Yeah. Yeah. I always get on with the idea that I'm just going to ride, put in my hour and, get off. And then a group comes by and you're jumping on it. And all of a sudden you're threshold for 20 minutes and you're like, what am I doing?
So what about joining some of the purpose built races that are going on? Do you ever bother with that?
I haven't done that. No, I haven't done that.
Any reason?
Probably because I don't like to be dropped and I'm afraid I'll be dropped.
So the old ego is still alive and kicking then.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh, maybe I wondered whether the Training Peaks guys had their own racing league at any time, because there's quite a few keen riders there, wasn't there?
Oh, that lunch ride at Training Peaks is like a Cat 2 race. You got a bunch of young guys that do race bikes. They're fit. They love to duke it out. It's not a fun lunch ride.
Mm. Well, let's go back a bit then, Jim. So, when did you retire, and how did you get into coaching? How soon after you retired was it, or was it? Well, were you coaching while you were still riding?
Yeah, so I started coaching while I was riding, and it wasn't really. I didn't intend to do that. I was racing bikes. I had a couple of training buddies. Some point along the line, one of the guys asked how did I training, because they would show up and we would go training, and I would say this is what we're going to do. And at the time, I was getting a degree in exercise physiology, so there was some thought behind it. And I explained to him how it worked and whatever, how I thought about it, and he asked if I would graduate his training. And initially, I was like, no way. If I go bad, it's one thing, but if you go bad because I give you bad training, then that's another story. And he just basically like, look, you ride it, I'll follow it. If it sucks, I won't say a word. And I was like, okay, we can give that a try and see what happens. And year one, he ended up earning a spot on our national team. And then as people started asking him about what he was doing for training, then he just directed them towards me, and probably by year two or year three of that, I had a pretty good stable of riders that I was coaching, and they were all succeeding, and it's just sort of started to happen.
Hmm.
We're talking like 92, 93. There wasn't really a coaching industry then. Joe Friel was, I happened to live in the same town Joe Friel did. Joe had a training business. He also owned a running shoe shop. And if you went into the shop, you could talk to him about training. So I would always go in and try on shoes. And that was sort of the catalyst to talk to Joe about training.
Yeah, I did a podcast with Joe when he talked about that. He said that the only guy that he knew that was coaching full time or coaching as a business was somewhere down in San Diego. So he got on a flight to go meet him because he'd never talked to another coach. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's a big trip, isn't it? Just to go, it's 2 or 3 hours of flying just to go meet somebody that's in the same business as you.
Yeah, and at that time in history, there just wasn't coaches. You just went out and rode. That's what you did. You'd put in your base miles, big base miles, do your group rides on the weekend, and then the races would start. And after 20 races, you would feel like you had some race fitness.
Yeah. So while you were at USA Cycling then, what was your role there in that first 17 years?
So initially, I started USA Cycling in 2001. So I'd been coaching for about 10 years. On my own, and had a really good business. That business in the 90s grew to 4 coaches and about 100 athletes, which is pretty, I think, unheard of. Mm-hmm. It's still, I think most people still consider that a really big business.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of really good women road racers. And around 2001, the USA Cycling was looking for a women's national team road coach. The performance director at that time reached out and asked if I was interested in being a road director. And of course I was, said yes, but I also really thought it was like a chance for me to differentiate myself as a coach from the other coaches that were starting to come in because the industry was starting to grow. And I'm like, well, if you can say you're a national team coach, that's a, that's significantly, a leg up on your competitors. So assuming like all good federations worldwide, that that job would last about 3 years. That was really sort of my outlook on it, and assumed that I would go back to my coaching business and be an entrepreneur. As it turned out, that's not how it really went. I spent 3 years as just primarily as a women's national team road coach. We won a silver medal in Athens in 2004. And as the Dutch coach told me after that race, you're a made man, Jim. They can't fire you now. not knowing what he was talking about, I do now. So yeah, then, it's, you know, responsibilities just sort of grew from there. I went in 2006, I took over all road programs. So I oversaw U23s, juniors, men, women road. 2008, we had lost a endurance track coach going into a World Cup season. So I put my hand up to take over the track program that winter, assuming that I would just go through the winter, go back to my normal job in the springtime, and they'd hire a new coach. Didn't quite work out like that. So I coached on the track for a few years. And then around 2009, was offered the position of director of athletics, which oversaw the entire athletic team and staff and athletes and pathways. And then from there, really started building it out and probably putting my fingerprint on all our programs and all our teams and pathways and how they operate and manage and function.
Jim, when you say director of athletics, so you have, is that moving away from cycling then to the full athletic program, track and field?
Nope. Athletics, that's just the name that we use internally. So when we say athletics and cycling, we just mean cycling teams.
Okay. So you you were coaching, and then you move to director. Is there a difference in role there? Is it less of a hands-on role and more of a sort of a program manager type thing, making sure that the athletes have got the right coaches, or do you retain some sort of personal involvement with the program and for the athletes?
Yeah, you know, typically it's strictly a sports administration job, sports management, budgets, planning, stakeholders, meetings, tons of meetings. I was still pretty young when I took that job. I was 37. I think by far the youngest of my peers in those roles, probably youngest by 10 years. And I was still coaching. So I continued to coach. It would have been more one-on-one coaching and personal coaching than running teams. But I think the first year, I think I still coached or ran the women's road team. And we just do meetings remotely, do whatever it took to make it work. As I really sort of grew in the job and grew in the position and understood more of what was required of me, then it became a lot more sports administration. Mm. But, it's a lot of, it's just a lot of meetings, a lot of budgets, a lot of planning, a lot of conversation. And really, you're coaching the coach at that point more so than coaching the athlete.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends who've ended up in similar roles in British Triathlon, and you know the step up from coach to administration manager. I'm not sure how well that sat with them, because at heart, when you're a coach, that you're not getting in the weeds, don't you? Getting your hands dirty, and then all of a sudden you've been removed from that, and you're doing budgets and going to meetings and sitting in interminable meetings with accountants talking about how much you can spend and why you can't do this.
Yeah, it's I think it's a hard transition, because you're going from warrior who's in the trench to chief who's far removed from the trench. Mm-hmm. And initially you miss that competition and that day-to-day work and process of creating winners. And and you're just removed from it enough that you just don't get a taste of it. I use this analogy all the time in this role that performance directors, they're really air traffic controllers. They sit in the tower. They know the elevation of all the planes. They know the speed of all the planes. They know what planes need to land, where the fuel is. And if they're in the planes being a pilot, while they can see it all, they can't manage it. And they can't land planes until they get out of the plane and get in the air tower control. So our job is really, it's air traffic control and putting people on the ground when you need to and getting them in the air when it's their time.
And do you have to get back in and fly the plane occasionally then, or have you done with flying now?
I love to fly the plane.
Yeah.
I still love to fly the plane. I still coach a handful of riders. Anytime I've agreed to do these jobs and even going to Training Peaks and coming back to USA Cycling, one of my primary requirements that I negotiate on, even before I negotiate salary, is I still get to coach.
Yeah.
Period. And it can, you know, at times people are like, why do you want to do that? And I'm like, if you ask me what I do in an elevator at a hotel, I'll tell you I'm a cycling coach. Mm-hmm. And then if we really get into it, then you find out that I'm much more than a cycling coach.
Yeah.
But coaching is my passion. It really is what I love to do. But the performance director jobs are, they're also great jobs and have their own rewards. Mm.
So you take the job as performance director at USA Cycling. I mean, USA is a huge country. You've got a big pool there. In my mind, you'd have been taking on a job that came with a huge budget to help develop your athletes. I mean, I've always thought that the USA is perhaps punching below its weight there in terms of medals, mm-hmm. for number of riders and the size of the country. When you compare, I mean, I'm thinking about the UK British Cycling from 2004 mm-hmm. onwards, the amount of medals they've won for the size of the country. So I'm wondering why, you know, what's the budget like and why haven't America been able to sort of compete with France as well, and Holland and Denmark, other yeah. small countries?
It's a good question. People ask me this all the time, and it's a fair question. I think a lot of the world sees us as this superpower, this unlimited resource of funding and technology and innovation and things that should be at our fingertips. Our challenge in America is we're not a government funded entity. The government doesn't fund the Olympic movement here at all. They do add rules to it. So they add hurdles, but they don't help you clear those hurdles. So in contrast to our peers who receive government funding, who are able to lobby for additional dollars, if we spend money, we raise that money. We either raised it through donors, through foundations, sponsors, membership, but anything we raise is what we get to spend. So we operate on about a third of the budget that GB does, and probably I think a lot of the larger Western European nations are probably slightly below GB, but they're above us.
Yeah.
And we have another interesting dynamic here too. So we all sit in America, the NGBs, national government bodies, sit beneath the Olympic Committee. We're all competing for the same dollar. So we're all chasing the same sponsor. In America, our Olympic Committee doesn't allow the NGBs to use the word Olympics, Olympic Games, use the Olympic rings, use any sort of imaging related to the Olympics. They save that for themselves. So they're able to go out and sell the Olympics and sell Team USA and sell the athletes for their monetary gain, but they don't extend those rights to us. They in turn then come back and through sports performance partners will divvy out money to NGBs, but not at the same rate they're taking it in. So it is a challenge. And you know, I suppose I've heard for the better part of 20 years, why don't you just go get a big corporate sponsor?
if only it was that easy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think anytime there's a corporate sponsor would put in that kind of money, they want access to the Olympic Games and Olympic rings. That's what is valuable to them and their organization. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they learn that they don't have that access through you, then they're asking, where can we get that access, which is the USOC. So you're basically hunting sponsors for the USOC. So it's challenging. You know, I think my counter to that argument is when we take the number of medals we won, and I'm proud to say that at least during my tenure, we've been the second highest Olympic medal producing nation behind GB. It pales in comparison to what GB has accomplished, but it's still more than everybody else. We're doing it on a significantly less dollar per medal. So our efficiency on spending that money is really good. We win where we can win. We make hard decisions on events and athletes where we can't. But we are very efficient at earning the medals we can.
So I guess what you're saying there is, if read it between the lines, is that you can't afford to just put athletes in for every race. You have to look at the potential for winning medals in that race and then sort of maybe splurge a little bit more of your budget on that one to get the medal, and maybe then have to sacrifice somebody getting a top five position or getting into the B final in another event.
Exactly.
Wow, that is some tough decisions. And of course, that is what the director of performance is there, isn't it? The decision making buck stops with you.
It does, and so do all the arguments.
They don't start with you, then they just finish with you.
They can start with me too, but they always finish at me.
So, if you're going to take on the role of a performance director, does that mean you have to have a thick skin to start with, or do you just develop one? Because as a coach, you sort of have some emotional investment, and and there'd be ups and downs that go alongside the performance of your athlete. Do you have to be more detached as a performance director?
It helps. It's hard though. You know, sport business is different than business. Sport by nature has passion and passionate people. And if you are involved in sport, you're very passionate about what you do. Business can just be business. You can go to the table, you can negotiate. 3 hours later, you decide you don't have any synergy or deal isn't going to work, and you just all go home and go to the next deal.
sounds like the Brexit negotiations at the moment.
We can get into that. So, you know, I think you develop thick skin. It's not always comfortable. For me, as long as I can make a decision and I feel like I can back that decision up factually and with some clarity and logic, then I'm okay making the decision. I would love to say that none of this gets to you and things that people don't say don't bother you. At the end of the day, we're all humans and we all hear it and we all see it. I can have 1,000 positive comments on something and I'll read the one negative one and feel bad. But at the end of the day, you have to make good decisions and consistently make correct decisions. And if you do, you'll be successful in the long run. And if you don't, you won't last long.
Yeah. Show me a leader who's never had to make a tough decision and felt bad about it, and I'll show you somebody who's not really leading very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, this year in particular has been challenging for everybody as coaches. I wondered how your coaching and approach to sport and has changed during the COVID era.
Yeah, this summer's been super challenging. I think the number of times everybody's hit the reset button, it's got to be infinite. I myself, towards August, was just like, man, I'm tired of resetting and writing new training programs and re-motivating athletes and re-encouraging them to engage and don't give up and continue to push yourself. I think in a typical year, if I have 10 athletes, for the most part, 8 or 9 of them will be going good all the time. And you'll just have the one athlete that is struggling. And so you can turn your attention to that one athlete and dig in and help them come out of that hole. But this summer, it felt like it was all over the place. You could have all 10 athletes bad at once. You could have five that were motivated, five unmotivated, seven engaged, three unengaged. It felt like it was 10 times the work this summer to just keep people on the path than other years. I don't know that I changed anything or made any changes through COVID, but I will say I felt like that just coaching in 2020 was infinitely more difficult than any other year I've coached.
And obviously there's always, you know, elite athletes are not immune from catching COVID. In fact, in some ways you might think that they're perhaps a little bit more at risk because they're training hard, they're trying to make gains. And so you have to push the boundaries a little bit. And sometimes you step over those, but the penalty for stepping over it perhaps this year and catching COVID could have bigger repercussions. So, how much of that time spent coaching did you spend trying to balance out the need to get the training in and to, once the Olympics have been cancelled, then obviously you've pushed that back for a year, but the need to keep people at the level they need to be at whilst maintaining their health and the integrity of their immune system?
Well, I think by nature, most elite athletes are somewhat germaphobes in the first place, and they live in their own little bubbles. They may not feel like they put themselves in isolation, but I think a large number of them do live like that anyways. Before you were always worried about getting the flu, getting a sinus infection, catching something that was going to derail your training. So I think you're relatively smart about what you did in the first place. I would say the one change is just going to restaurants and socializing. And that this year didn't happen, and that would be the change. But otherwise, I think they're generally pretty conscious about what's going on, is washing hands and things of that nature.
And what about not having races to go to? Because athletes, that's the whole nature of them, isn't it? You mentioned it before about doing Swift and your own sort of feelings about that. Athletes love to race. Now there's no races. They've got all this training they're doing. There's no way to express that fitness. There's no way to get that sort of buzz that they get. And then there's some online stuff. And I saw some triathletes that were doing these virtual Ironman races every other weekend. And you think, well, there's going to be a burnout there eventually. And I guess you were having to coach remotely. So how are you managing all of that situation?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that a lot of athletes got into a lot of challenges, if you will, that kept them engaged and kept them motivated, but maybe weren't great for their actual development as an athlete or their form or their fitness or and fatigue. I guess fatigue would be the big piece. You know, I had some athletes that had to have challenges in front of them all the time. So whether it was a Strava segment or a fastest known time, they were always hunting challenges to pursue. And for me as a coach, on occasion it became a distraction because it wasn't leading towards what you were working towards. But their minds would not let it go, and they would continue to want to chase this fastest known time, and you're just making compromises in training that you normally wouldn't make.
Yeah. Lionel, sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say at one point towards the end of summer, I had a big red letters on my whiteboard in my office: no more compromises. Because I was just tired of compromising with the challenges and the Strava segments and the fastest known times. I'm like, look, we're going to have a race season. We don't know what it is, but we have to focus on what we're trying to do here.
Yeah. I mean, if you look in triathlon, Lionel Sanders takes to social media a lot. So he had this thing going with Sam Long about trying to get the fastest times up Mount Lemmon. And then they were arguing about where the real finish was. You know, did you go to the cafe here? Did you actually go to the summit? You know, he was posting all that stuff. And then he suddenly pivoted and he decided he wanted to go for that Canadian hour record on the track. And I think he'd probably only ridden a track bike once. So that was it. But he was still trying to train for triathlon and get ready for Daytona, which just happened. And clearly hasn't done too badly because he came fourth there. I think he broke his 5K PB, so he was clearly going for that challenge at the same time. And yet yeah. Lionel's not a particularly good swimmer. So you can see how... I know his coach actually, Dave Tilbury Davis, and I guess for Dave, he would have had the same challenges as you as the athlete, saying, I think I might do this and I'm going to do that and I've been up here doing this, and but I still want to be a good triathlete.
Yeah, I'm sure he lived that too.
Mm. Let me ask you about, because I don't believe you had any skin in the game there, so maybe we can talk freely. The Tour de France, the Giro, the Vuelta, some surprising results this year. You know, we had the youngest ever winner, well, for over 100 years of the Tour de France there, and that last but one day meltdown from Roglic. We had Gegen Hart coming from behind, you know, a completely unexpected and win the Giro, and then Roglic managing to pull it round and winning the Vuelta. I mean, why do you think we had some guys who should have been right at the top of the game, like Bernal and maybe Froome's an exception because he was still coming back from the accident, but certainly Bernal and some of the others, why do you think they completely failed to show? And then we got other guys who wouldn't have been in the picture and on anybody's radar at all, suddenly coming right to the very top.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I thought that those three Grand Tours were three of the best Grand Tours in a long time.
I agree. And fantastic spectator sports.
Oh, they were wasting my morning because I would wake up and watch the race the entire time, and they happened, you know, in quick succession. So I'm like losing 9, 10 weeks, 12 weeks.
Yeah, you weren't the only one.
Of work because I'm watching these races. I thought they were fantastic. I thought they were awesome. I think you had a lot of guys that you could see that through COVID stayed really focused on what they were doing. I would guess that their performance teams did a great job of keeping them engaged and focused on what they're doing. And then I think there were other guys that probably were less focused on preparation, not knowing what the season was going to happen or not. And then it happened. And if you came into the season with good form, you were okay. You could do good results. But if you didn't have good form right away, it was such a short season and so condensed that you didn't have time to build that form. Mm. So,
but it makes me think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the work that Tim Kerrison does with Ineos and how he uses training peaks to monitor everybody's data and how he's so hot on that. And I guess he's not the only one, you know, that you've got the team performance managers, all the top teams managing that. So I just wondered that if they were monitoring that and able to see the numbers and everything else, how could it have gone so wrong? I mean, is it in the mind? Is it about the nutrition and the pacing? You know, could you go into a race like the Tour de France with the right numbers and, you know, the right performance levels compared to previous years, but then completely blow up on your tactics? Or does the pressure of being the reigning champion get to somebody so young?
Yeah, all three. I mean, really, the Tour can be decided in a few bad moments on a climb. So mentally racing anyways, especially climbing or time trialing, at some point you always have that doubt that creeps in your mind and you're like, can I do this? And if it wins, you get dropped, you come off the wheel, you lose 20 seconds. Maybe you fight for it and you get it back, but it can be decided just that fast. So it's all the above, really.
When it's going right, it's going right.
Think, you know, they're really good. These World Tour teams now, the performance directors or the performance staff in these teams are really good. And I think in the last... I would even say the last 10 years, it's just been a boom, right? I mean, 2010, 2012, really maybe only Team Sky and Ineos were doing anything on that sort of level. Mm-hmm. And they just raised the game. And if anybody wants to compete with them, they had to raise their game. And that really evolved this performance director roles and requirements and needs and careers, really.
Interesting that normally in the Tour de France, they talk about having to have a big team. You know, you've got to have your climbers aligned so they can, you know, pull the team. And you've seen Ineos and Sky doing that over the years. Jumbo-Visma did that. But Pogacar, he basically rode on his own or with one guy, just sitting on the back of Visma, didn't he, or Ineos? And I mean, that's smart riding. I know he's obviously got talent. And Dirk did a podcast with Inigo Sanmilani's coach, and yep, they talked about his VO2 max. And I always think when coaches say you could see from a young age he was going to be a world champion, no, you couldn't. You could see from a young age he probably had the right things to be a world champion, but nobody can really truly say how it's going to play out in the next 10 years. Yeah. But clearly he's got all the tools. But I just wonder how much the recklessness of youth and the sort of like devil take the high road type approach helped him there. You know, I've got nothing to lose, so let's go for it. And if I come second or third, then nobody expected that anyway. And if I win, I win.
Yeah. I think they were actually raced a very intelligent race the entire time. I think they knew Pogačar's ability in that time trial. And Roglic is no slack in a time trial. But I think that they set that entire race up to give Pogačar a shot at the very end. And they used Lotto Jumbo as their own team. Lotto Jumbo controlled the whole thing. They controlled the race. Pogačar never was very far down on GC. The only time he moved or got out of the wheel or got in the wind was at the very end of climbing stages when he had chances to take seconds. Mm-hmm. They didn't ever throw the big haymaker punch and go all in on something. And, I think you credit Alan Piper for that strategy and that tactic, because it was a brilliant piece of tactician right there.
Bit like Ali, the rope-a-dope. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Take 10 rounds of punishment. Fantastic. and then deliver the big hit in the 11th round.
Yep. So I think that they just rode a really, really good tactical race. And I think going into that race, at least with Pogačar, you're like, he's going to make the first groups climbing. He is a good time trialist. He's going to do a good race. There's no question he's going to do a good race. It's just like, does he not have a bad day? And that can define a grand tour as just a single bad day.
So let me ask you this question then. It seems like the contenders are getting younger. Used to be the contention that you would only really win a grand tour if you'd done, you know, half a dozen years of gaining experience. You see people moving through, they're in the top 10, they're in the top five, they win one of the jerseys, and then they're considered a GC contender. In the last two or three years, particularly with Bernal and Pogacar, we've seen, and Roglic really as actually a professional mm-hmm. cyclist isn't really that old, is he? He's only been in the sport
Correct.
For years. We've seen guys that are much younger. Is that got something to do with their development at a young age, or is it just belief that you can do it?
I think it has a lot to do with the development at the younger age. It used to be going from juniors to U23s was a large step. The volume, the intensity, the length of races was just a big step that you had to overcome and adapt to. Juniors into the world, or sorry, U23s in the World Tour ranks is a big step. It would take two or three years to adapt to that level. But I think I think we've got better with our training. I think we've got better with managing load, with monitoring load, with understanding fatigue. And I think coaches are able to push athletes a little bit further younger without getting into that burnout area because they can manage the fatigue. Mm-hmm. So consequently, we're all developing better, younger riders. And now an 18-year-old is not far off the level of a World Tour guy if he's that sort of talent. Mm-hmm. I think like a Remco, he's a different story. You can't look at him as an example, but he's phenomenal. But some of the other guys that go from U23s, Hershey. I mean, Hershey had an incredible tour, right? He was a U23 guy 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Top rider now. Lee, same thing. When he started to show his prominence, he was still a really young guy out of U23s. You have some guys like Quinn Simmons who goes from junior straight to World Tour and while he may not have won any big races, he's finishing top 10 in sprints. That's legit for an 18-year-old kid. Mm. So I think a lot of it has to do with just being better trainers and physiologists and understanding and being able to monitor load and fatigue.
Well, talking of monitoring load and fatigue, if you're working with athletes remotely, what sort of metrics do you look at? Obviously, there's the power data and you know how they're working towards that power and what they're capable of. But what other sorts of things do you look at to tell you that your athletes are in the right place in terms of their recovery and their sort of resting metrics?
Yep. I think the most important thing that I can say about this is no one piece will tell you the complete story. You have to look at all the pieces to put together the story. I use, of course, all the Training Peaks analytics. I use WKO5. I use HRV, resting heart rate. I even like RP. Yep.
Can I add just on HRV there, because that's a big favorite of mine at the moment. What do you use to gather the data there from your athletes?
So I was a really early adopter on Whoop, and I know that.
Me too.
And I know when everybody says about, you know, where it's measured and it can be measured in a better location, but there's also this, what is an athlete willing to do, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody wants to walk around their entire life with a chest strap on.
Nope.
A band around your bicep is weird. There's just no way to say it other than that. On the wrist, maybe it's not perfect, but it's not invasive. It's not obtrusive. You have no problem doing it. You put it on and for the most part, you never take it off. So you get data. It's consistent. It's there every day. So for me, it's good enough. When I first started using Whoop, or I guess this is probably 2017,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know whether I should believe it or not. Right. And it's just, you're like, it's a new tool. It's a new piece of technology. Is it telling you what you think it's telling you? Can you validate it? I really would just look at the data, look at all the other data I would look at, and then see how the athletes performed. And almost always when HRV was short or resting heart rate was elevated or rising, their ability to perform would start to decrease. And as it went the other way, their ability to perform would start to increase.
Yep. I'm pretty much aligned with what you're saying there. I've not tried the bicep band yet, but I think I got mine in March 2017. So mm-hmm. I'm on version 3 now, which seems to be a lot more robust in terms of the data. The version 3. Mm-hmm. I had the same reservations as you. You know, I'm waking up one morning feeling like Tigger, and yet it's telling me my scores are 15% and I'm in the red. I think it does overread a little bit on heart rate, particularly at the high end. I've started recently comparing the HRV to the data provided by HRV for training using a chest strap just for a minute in the morning. And they seem to run pretty much the same, you know, when one's high, the other one's high, when one's low, the other one's low. So it gives me a bit more confidence that that data is robust. And I think the sleep stuff's interesting as well. I know that there's some athletes I've coached that get irritated by it. It's like, I've got a hard session to do and it's telling me it's red. And it's like, well, this is your autonomic nervous system. It is what it is. Instead of getting frustrated, what you need to be doing is looking into all of the other stuff in your life around that to see why it might be coming out red. You know, I think you learn a lot about yourself as well or about your lifestyle. Like the influence of alcohol on sleep is a big one for me. You know, even if it's a glass of wine, the timing of that wine at 6 p.m. with dinner versus just before you go to bed can be critical in terms of those first couple of hours in sleep and accessing deep sleep. So using it to learn about things and lifestyle is interesting. So HRV then, what WKO, any other data collectors and metrics that you use?
No, not direct measurements. I still like to hear the athlete's voice.
Mm.
I really do. You know, you can look at a power file. You can see what you think you see. If you give them a 3x10 workout, a threshold, you know exactly what it should look like before you even get the file.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're getting a couple metrics that might be in disagreement with each other, especially you get the HRV, you get resting heart rate, but then you see a TSS score or a performance management chart with TSB that suggests is positive, then you have to talk to them. You have to ask them what they think and where they feel like they're at. And I will say with HRV, I mean, it is an algorithm, right? It's not a a direct measurement. So give that thing a grain of salt as well. I mean, it doesn't mean that a negative or a poor HRV doesn't mean you can't perform. If you track HRV on Grand Tour riders, after the day five, you're like, well, you're done. You can't perform. Yet they do it over and over and over and over. So you do have to hear their voice. And I think it's important. Even, you know, I think good coaches, even the deflection of a voice or the tone of a voice says something other than what the athlete's saying. And I think over time you get good at hearing what they're saying, even if it might not be what they're saying.
Interesting. I think certainly EF education data have been using the WHOOP this year, and there's quite a bit of I'll make a reference to that in the show notes, but there's quite a bit of data in their blogging about how the athletes are using it and some of the numbers that they're coming out with and sleep performances. There was the guy that raced last year, the young American that had a really horrendous crash and spent most of his time wearing the Lanterne Rouge that was wearing
it. Lawson Craddock. So I actually coach Lawson, and he and WHOOP are the ones that got me on WHOOP that year. And we were just looking at WHOOP data before the tour, really. I mean, that's how it all started. And then he has this big crash. They actually had an interesting marketing campaign that they were going to run around Lawson about how to use HRV and talk about it. I was part of it. And then he crashes. And all of a sudden, this is like a worldwide story. They really did get some awesome mileage out of that. But it was also really awesome. It was cool to see for Lawson. I mean, he went through days of like single digit in the red scores. And, you know, we're starting every day like, look, just try to get through the day. And then all of a sudden they started turning yellow. And then by week three, they were green. And you're like, this is crazy.
I guess there's an interesting link there between your HRV and being in the fight or flight, you know, sympathetic hormonal state, that if you've had a big accident like that, even if you're recovering from the visible cuts and bruises and abrasions, your insides take a hell of a bashing, don't they? Your internal organs, and they're perhaps recovering for a lot longer. And of course, while they're recovering, your body's creating adrenaline and cortisol to help deal with the pain. And that's going to have an impact on HRV and an impact on your recovery. And also, when you've got those bruises, you fall asleep, but then you roll over onto one and you wake up and you've got pain and you can't get back to sleep again. So recovery's worse than it would be anyway.
Yeah. And that's great. It's a great measure of it. I think the real value of WHOOP is, as you mentioned earlier, is lifestyle, but it coaches you to sleep. And if you have negatives or you have low scores and you're in the red and you want to stay on that training block, it really is like a impetus to take a nap. It's an impetus to go to bed earlier. It's an impetus to try to reduce stress and all these things that you can get back in the green and you feel like you're capable of continuing that training block. And ultimately that is all great stuff for training, because you can train harder, longer, more.
It's been interesting for me. I've just been on a training camp. I had 3 weeks out in the sun, and you know, it was hot and humid, a bit like Hawaii. Training and swimming with a client every day, riding at 6 o'clock in the morning, so getting up at, you know, 5:15 to get all my mobility working. Being dehydrated, but having some really high green scores. Now I'm back in the UK, and I've got over the jet lag, but I'm struggling to get out of the red. So there's a hang. I'm sleeping well, but maybe there's a, you know, maybe it's taking me a lot longer to recover. Maybe it's because I was in a country where we had lots of sunshine and I was getting all the melatonin produced and, you know, the bright light. And now I'm back in the UK and it's 4 o'clock now. It's dark outside. It's been grey. There's no real sunlight. There's no vitamin D production. Maybe it's that when you're away from your normal environment in the sort of monastic lifestyle of a camp, it's just everything's around training and relaxing when you're at home. Yeah. Even if they're tiny little things, they're stresses that all go in the stress bucket, aren't they, and build up. And then when you add training in on top of that, it impacts recovery. It's been fascinating for me to try and sort of like do a Sherlock Holmes and work out what's the difference between the two and how much of an impact that has.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's right. It's at home, you have distractions that you're not aware of that are actually distractions and cause stress. And sometimes when you're on the road, you just have none of that.
Mm. Are you wearing it yourself then, Jim, still?
I do. Yeah. I don't have it on right now, but I do have one. Yeah.
Do you, are you a fan of, based on what you said, are you a fan of the bicep strap then, or do you still use the wrist strap?
I use the Whoop.
But you have it on the wrist or do you have it on the bicep?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I keep it on the wrist. Yeah. I would never wear it on the bicep. Even if it's better, it just is weird and it feels weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say the new straps that they've got out are much better for swimming. The old ones used to stretch as you got some water underneath them. So I quite like it for that. Jim, we've got probably 20 minutes left. So I wanted to try and get some input from you about how our triathlete listeners can prepare to improve their cycling. I mean, it's the biggest proportion of any event, and so therefore it has a big impact on finishing time, but it also has a big impact on your running performance. Whilst we're talking about lifestyle and sleep and heart rate variability, it's my contention that we should prioritize these before we even start laying on the training. Because what I see with most triathletes is they start training, they get into the weeds with the swim, bike and run, and then they get injured or ill, and then they backtrack to find out what they can do to improve. So it seems like if you get your sleep nailed on first, if you have a really good nutrition program where you sort of 90% of what you eat is really good, real food, you know, no processed stuff, no sugar, you look after those other metrics, you keep your stress down, then you can start to layer the training on. What emphasis would you ask people to put on those lifestyle elements as in terms of its overall impact on your ability to improve?
Well, I think those lifestyle impacts are also like training. The more you do of it, the more you do training, the more layers of paint you can add to the canvas. I think as you get into these type of sports and the more involved you get in them and the more engaged you are and the more interested you are in your own performance, the lifestyle traits also become like that canvas where you just start layering different levels of paints on them. And if you try to do everything all at once, you'll probably fail. You'll probably go crazy and think that this is the most psychotic thing you've done in your life. Mm. But if it evolves over time, then pretty soon you've created these really good lifestyle traits that you do automatically without even being aware you're doing them. And it's just, you do one, you become proficient at it. You add another, you become proficient at it. You add another, you become proficient at it. And then all of a sudden you have this toolbox of lifestyle traits that you just do naturally, automatically.
So when we're looking at putting together our winter training, what are the key focuses? You know, I mean, there's a big focus on this FTP number, which is a bit like your VO2 max. And I know particularly in triathlon and particularly longer distance triathlon, I'm not sure how relevant having a high VO2 max is to your performance in a half Ironman or an Ironman. What emphasis do you put on things like FTP over power to weight, for example?
Yeah, well, I think you have to look at the sport you're doing and the demands of that sport and what the real requirements for performance are. If you're a classics rider, single day rider, VO2 is huge.
Yeah.
Because you're consistently going to be above threshold and consistently working in those anaerobic intensities, and you have to be efficient at that and recovery and going back and forth. If you're a stage racer, you're a GC rider, you're going to spend a lot of time at threshold, but not a ton of time over threshold, because it's just it's a long game. GC racing is a long game. You play it every day and you just have to be consistent at it. Ironmans, half Ironmans, the bike leg is something entirely different, right? I mean, rarely do you win the race on the bike leg. It's important, but you typically win on the run, and that's where it all falls apart. So, I think in Ironmans and half Ironmans, being efficient on the bike is probably king. Efficiency is heart rate at a certain workload or power output watts. It can be aerodynamics. It can be the amount of millimoles of lactate you produce at a certain workload. So, you know, I think depending upon the event you're doing, dictates how important these different parameters are.
Hmm. Do you, there's also a lot of emphasis, and I've spent a lot of time talking to people like Steven Seiler about polarized training. You know, when they talk about pro cycling, they say that is reflected there. You know, you can spend a lot of time above threshold, and then you could spend 90% of your time riding, and you're probably below your aerobic threshold, just tootling along. Mm-hmm. But you've got to be able to respond and have that there. Is polarized training just the way cycle training would has evolved, or is there a deliberate policy to program it like that? So it's sort of like on that 80-20 or 90-10, whichever metric you use.
I think from the maybe late '90s, early 2000s, the Tudor Bompa periodization, I think it's changed quite a bit from that mm-hmm. period of time. Seiler, I tend to agree with the most of all the physiologists in training.
Right.
What he says resonates the most with me and how I've evolved as a coach and how I've evolved the training that I prescribe. I really prescribe to this, build the engine. You make an athlete, as fit as you can, and then you focus on specializing as you approach the event. So depending on event demands and what's needed, then you specialize as you get closer. Historically, almost any rider I work with will be really good year round. They'll ride at a pretty high level year round, but as we get to events where they peak, then we turn the dials, if you will, to fine tune that final preparation into what they're trying to accomplish.
So how far away from a peak would you say most, you know, those athletes that you talk about being pretty good most of the year round, is it really just that the peaking adds 5% and the mental aspect as well, the sort of psychology that, right, I'm at my peak now, so I'm going to perform better, but you don't really actually get that much fitter?
No. It's just amplifying their good traits and hopefully turning down the bad ones. You know, I think anytime you have an athlete training consistently, they're training, you know, doing good training blocks. If you take that volume away, they almost always improve, right? So you get the initial bump just straight away. You know, I think I've in my career, I've got a lot of credit for always peaking athletes on the day. And while it always feels good to hear that, and people, when somebody says you're awesome at getting them perfect on the day, I'm like, well, I can't actually say that any of them have been perfect on that day. Generally, you know, a week or 2 weeks leading up to that event, they're in that zone all the time, and everything they do is that good. So it just comes through on the day, and it appears that was the day.
Yes.
But I think it's all when you're getting to that level and you're peaking at, you know, those type of events, it's really dialing in of all the specific pieces you need to perform on that day. And it all just, it's like like when you're cooking, it all comes together at once. And up to that point, it can be everywhere.
Yeah. I often think that most athletes are actually a lot closer to their fitness than they think they are. It's just that mentally they're not prepared. So if I said to people training for Ironman, well, we're going to do one next weekend, they're like, oh, I'm not ready. But actually, if you had a gun to their head, they'd be able to do it, and they do reasonably well. And then they go along and they go through their specific training phase and their taper, and that's when they say, well, I'm ready now, because that's where their mind's been geared to them being ready in June.
Yep.
But actually, the difference in performance will be quite small.
Yep.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Bill Sweetnam, the swim coach from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was performance director of British Swimming maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But his thing then for the swimmers was, you know, I might ask you to do a 400 time trial or a 200 time trial at any time, and you should be within this percentage of your medal winning performance or the world record performance or your PB. Yeah. And that frightened a lot of athletes. But when he explained the physiology and the fact that you shouldn't really be having these huge peaks and troughs, it's sort of like that with a little spike.
Yeah.
I think they got a lot more comfortable, and they actually surprised themselves that they could stay fairly close to their peak performance year round.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a super underappreciated tool in training. We talk a ton about physiology and physiological adaptations and what we're trying to achieve out of training, But there's a psychological benefit out of training. And I think as a coach, if you're aware of that and you're tuned into that, you're training the psyche along with the physiology all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's, to me, that can be the difference between a good coach and a great coach. I know my athletes, when they get into a race, if you end up in a break with them, or you're in a gutter with them, you're on a climb with them, you have to beat them in a time trial, your odds are not looking good. But I'm continually pushing that warrior mindset. And even in training, when they don't think that they can accomplish something, I'll push them into it and challenge them to do it. And, you know, a lot of times they don't realize it, but they're developing that warrior mindset. And, mm-hmm. and that goes into race day. If you don't ever put somebody in that position before race day, it's hard to ask them to be a warrior on race day.
Mm. Yeah. So those sessions where you're making them suffer and they think, you know, that you wouldn't want to hear what they're calling you behind your back. It's all part of the process, isn't it? Because if you've been through that suffering once and you've come through it at the other end, you know, yeah. you can do it again when it really matters, and a little bit more, because there's the sort of the winning line, or the, you know, the PB or whatever it is also in front of them.
Yeah. I think as a coach, sometimes too, you have to show an athlete what they're capable of. So similar to your analogy earlier of I'm going to ask you to do an Ironman next week and an athlete backs out of it. Sometimes you just have to show them they're capable of that and mm-hmm. push them into it. And it's hard to make somebody do something, but if they're working with you, they clearly want to accomplish something. Mm-hmm. So you have a little bit of authority and leverage to get them to do it. But all the time I'll take an athlete and I'll take a day where I'm just like, you know, today's the day I'm going to show you what you're capable of. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily say that up front, but when they're done, they absolutely get it.
Yeah, going back to the mindset thing, I've also observed that often people will set PBs when they're not expecting to. So they go into something like a training race. So they haven't really backed mm-hmm. off, they haven't tapered, but they're totally relaxed. They don't have the nerves. They may be a little bit nervous, but they don't have the nerves they have before a big race. So there's no tension. So everything's done in a nice, loose, efficient way. Mm-hmm. And they set a PB and it's like, where did that come from? You know, I'm not even at my peak yet. But then on race day, they totally bomb. But you know yep. that, you know, you'll know that your job as a coach is to get them to the start line in the best shape possible. Once the gun goes off, that's it. There's nothing more you can do, is there, really?
Yep.
And then if they don't perform, then that's down to probably what's in their head, or the strategy again, which is controlled by what's yep. in the head. So, just sort of emphasizing yeah. the importance of the psychology and learning how to relax on the big occasion. I think maybe that's something that the best athletes have, is knowing how to relax when everybody else is tense.
Yeah. My very first Olympic Games in 2004, I had a peer coach who said, he asked me why I was nervous. And I was like, because it's the Olympics, I don't want to screw it up. And he's like, and what if you screw it up? I'm like, well, that would be terrible. He's like, why? I'm like, well, because it's the Olympics. He's like, you'll get a shot in 4 more years. He's like, the point of the Olympics is getting to the point where it's not really the Olympics. It's just a race. And it no longer has that effect on you. And when you get to that point, then you're dangerous. An athlete's dangerous. A coach is dangerous because they can perform. And I'd always remember that. And long ago, I got to where world championships were just world championships. The next weekend, you would have another race and you were just on to the next show. Mm-hmm. And you know, we got to a point where we were continually producing at those levels. But then the Olympics, and I go to Rio and I coach Kristen Armstrong, three-time Olympic gold medalist. And you wouldn't have known the day of the Olympics in Rio that it wasn't even an Olympic Games for her. It was a time trial in her town, in her hometown. She warmed up on a trainer, no frills, no media, no lights, no camera, nothing, just warming up, and literally looked at me 2 times to ask if the tactic we were going to race was still on track and what time was it, so she knew when to go to the start house. Nothing more than that.
Yeah. I remember the just before that time trial we talked about in the Tour de France, you know, the penultimate day. Roglic focused with all his kit on, ready on the trainer, sweating. Pogacar messing around on his phone, shirt off, sending texts to people. And I think Chris Boardman was probably saying, "Oh, he's too relaxed there." You know, then what happens? He carries it off, and Roglic blows. Maybe there was a bit of that. Listen, Jim, I'm looking at the time here. I know you've got a few minutes left, so I've got two quick questions for you, and then want to get just sort of your top five tips for our cycling triathletes. Thoughts on nutrition? A lot of the athletes that I come into contact with like to talk about keto, low carb, high fat, you know, paleo. Your thoughts as a coach, and you know, because I guess your athletes will be exposed to the same media hype as everybody else about dietary. Dietary wonders. So how do you handle that?
Well, first of all, I stay in my lane and I do what I'm good at. I'm not a nutritionist. I will always encourage somebody to work with a nutritionist and work through the issues and or work through the topics. But in general, I'm a pretty straightforward guy on nutrition. I think you need carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are fuel. They fuel the body. Eat carbohydrates. They're not the enemy. High quality foods, you know, real food, vegetables, real meat, all the above. So I'm not really crazy on nutrition. I have to say I'm not a big fan of ketones. I've tried them. I've not had great success with them. In my experience, they always put an athlete in a low energy state. They might get through the workout, but the next couple of days are always terrible. For me, it's about consistency. And it doesn't mean that they're wrong or I'm wrong or they're right. It's just for me, I've not had success with them in athletes. The fasted rides, that was a big thing a while ago, a couple of years ago. Same thing, and not a ton of success with fasted rides. I read the science. I know the science. I understand the science. But I've not had great success with it. And I don't think with my athletes, fuel efficiency is an issue. Being able to swap between different fuel substrates within their body, I don't feel like that's ever been an issue. Whenever we go into lab and test, it never shows that's a problem. So I play a pretty straight up the middle on nutrition.
Yeah, the fasted, I've tried all these myself. You know, the thing is that the more you go away from just eating real food, the more you go away from the basics, the more thought and planning it requires. And when you've got to fit in 20 hours of training a week, and then you've got to think, right, where am I going to do my fasted ride? When am I going to eat? When am I going to get the maximum adaptation? You know, what should I be eating? What shouldn't I be eating? You're adding another layer of complexity, which you don't need to do. And if it goes wrong and they end up in an energy deficit, then the benefits from one session are wiped out by three poor sessions. So you're actually in a net loss, aren't you, really, after all of that?
Yep. There's a term Sky used to probably 4 or 5 years ago called functional dehydration. And when the first time I heard this, I'm just like, oh my God, I hope this does not resonate with people, because this is going to be a nightmare to fight all the time.
Yeah.
Functional dehydration was they would plan for an athlete's loss of water to coincide with the last 15 minutes of a climb, so that they had this super powered weight because they'd lost all this water weight, but they could get to the finish before they blew up or bonked or detonated. And then they would rehydrate the rest of the night as you normally would. In theory, makes awesome sense. But for a normal user, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be a ton to overcome.
Well, like marginal gains, you know, everybody, that was a big thing. Everybody's like, yeah, I need marginal gains. Well, you do, but what about the big, there's some big things in front of you, some big gains. You don't need marginal gains yet. You know, you don't need to worry about shaving grams off here or doing this. Just get more sleep, eat real food and make sure you get recovery. Strength training, Jim, for cycling, relevant or not? And if so, what type? And when?
Big fan of it. I'd have the majority of my athletes strength train. I would say the most difficult is the world tour guys, and that their schedule is so packed and it's involves so much travel and so much time in hotels that it is difficult to be consistent with it, but I'm a big fan of it. Lean muscle mass isn't heavy. More muscle mass is more strength, which is more power. So you've got two levers, really. You've got weight and you've got power. I say you try to build the power first and build as much power as you can. And then you worry about the weight as a fine tuner. So I have almost all my athlete strength training.
And let's face it, if you're riding 20 hours a week, it's at the opposite end of the spectrum to doing heavy lifting. So even if you are lifting heavy, you aren't going to generate a big amount of muscle, are you? Because it's just physiologically one cancels out the other anyway.
Yep. Correct.
Yeah. Oh, that's good then. So always think, when you see some riders that are just so solid when they're climbing, there's no torso movement, there's no head bobbing. Is that accidental or is it deliberate because the coaches have worked on core strength, shoulder girdle strength, and good riding technique as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is your core is your transmission. And if you have a leaky transmission, then you're going to leak power.
Yeah. Let's finish off, Jim, with your top five tips. If a triathlete's listening now and they're going, well, what are my takeaways? What are the things that they should be focusing on over the next few months to come out of the winter and into the spring as a stronger, more efficient cyclist?
Number one is consistency. That is always going to be king. If you're consistent and deliberate about a practice, it will get better. It has to get better. There's no way it won't. Two, because we talked about rest and whoops, I would always say rest. An analogy I use all the time for athletes is if you could get a boost of growth hormone, a boost of testosterone, a boost in your performance, and not test positive, would you do it? And all say yes.
And for free.
And for free. And I'm like, take a nap.
Yeah.
Take a nap every day and it's free and you won't test positive. So rest and granted in a normal person's life, balancing family, training, job, life, a nap isn't always feasible, but, a nap on Sunday is, so it could be one nap a week. It could be something along those lines, but make it a priority.
Find ways to get more rest, not more training, I think.
Yep. I think a big thing in sport, especially age groupers, is be focused and know what it is you're actually trying to accomplish. I mean, I think for the most part, an age grouper wants to be fit. They want to look good. They want to be healthy. If you're able to endure this sort of training, then you clearly have a little bit of an ego for vanity and all that comes with it. But I think it's important to know what it is you're really trying to accomplish. Are you trying to, get a top 20? Are you trying to get a top 50? What event is it that you're really focused on? And then don't deviate from that. Don't get distracted by the event that's coming up in 2 weeks or something that popped up in a 10K running race that wasn't part of your program or wasn't part of your direction that you shift courses for.
Yeah.
Know what it is you're trying to accomplish and be laser focused on it. So maybe I'll leave three instead of five.
Okay, that's fine. Consistency is king. It comes up every time. I looked at a training diary I had from 1989 when I went to Israel with a British triathlon champion. And that was the thing that I open that diary now and the first thing on the inside cover is consistency is the key to success. Never goes away, that one.
Nope.
And rest, underrated rest and sleep. Yep. Seriously.
Very
and it's,
much so.
You know, I'm going to buy a gadget. No, have some sleep is free.
Yeah. We're all very good at punishing ourselves and self-inflicted pain and suffering and discipline and all those things, but we're typically very poor at resting.
Jim, it's been amazing. You've given us some fantastic nuggets today and some really, really sound, sensible information. If people wanted to follow you, where can they find you?
I have an Instagram at Jim Miller Time. I have a Twitter at Jim Miller Time. That would be it.
Jim Miller Time. Okay, we'll put that. All right. Instagram and Twitter. Brilliant. Well, Jim, great to catch up again. Sad that we couldn't catch up at a coaching summit this year and have one of those beers that you like. It's always nice to meet up. Hopefully the world will return to some sort of normality soon and we'll be able to share a beer somewhere in the world.
We'll look forward to it.
Best wishes to you and to all your athletes for Tokyo next year. Let's hope it goes ahead in some format and that everybody gets what they want in some way. So, best wishes and thanks very much for being here today.
Yeah, good, great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, you're welcome. Listeners, that's it for today. Another great guest, as I promised, and we'll be coming up with more great guests in the future. But for now, enjoy the rest of your week.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.